and welcome to, oh my gosh, episode 43 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, an episode we're calling Out with the Old and In with More Old. I'm Jerry Shario, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you the guy who came up with that title. Of course, this time of the year, you know, we ring out the old, we ring in the new, but we're going to leave this guy right where he is. Here's Nick Santa Maria.
I was going to talk to you about that because I was not going to go any further without a ring. So, between the two. Oh my. Okay. No, and I'm talking about the ring, you know, that goes around my finger, not the one written by Wagner. Hi, everybody. And I just want to say right off the bat, if I may, Happy New Year to everyone. It is New Year's Eve, 2025. Woo-hoo. We're about to go into 2026, marked down from 2030. And we're looking forward to it. And right now, I'd like to wish everyone a Happy New Year in a very special way. Here we go.
Oh, out with the old, in with the new. I've got a special message for you. I'm wishing my friends a happy new year. Drink some champagne, blow on a horn. You're gonna pay the following morn. I'm wishing my friends a happy new year. Oh, you can think of the future, remember the past, but this I can vow. The future's not here and the past doesn't last. The only thing that matters is now. So keep making plans, it's what people do. Even though fate is laughing at you, I'm wishing my friends a happy new year. You can think of the future, remember the past, but this I can vow. The future's not here, the past doesn't last. The only thing that matters is now. So keep making plans, it's what people do. Even though fate is laughing at you, I'm wishing my friends a happy, wishing my friends a healthy, wishing my friends a happy and healthy new year.
Go. That was an original song.
Yay.
For all of you, for all of our friends out there in podcast land. Podcast land. That's where we live, Gary. Podcast land.
Yeah.
I think Mr. Potter owns it.
Give them podcast land. Give them show that rabble.
Well, Mr. Potter, you have sweaty hands. Anyway, I could have said sweaty something else, but then I'd be on Saturday Night Live. We're off to a rousing start, aren't we?
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. Anyway, I want to introduce, first of all, my friend Jerry Shario, who's now in Washington, D.C.,
yes.
Trying to pull the letters off of the Trump-Kennedy Center. Now, did you see that yet, or is that still on your agenda?
You know, we have not. I saw the backside of the building as we were driving through part of the city, but it's mm-hmm. on the agenda. I think today or maybe tomorrow morning we're going to be popping in there, and I'm bringing a crowbar. Yes, I am.
Okay. I'm in full support. So you saw the back of it, but you'll see the front of it, and take pictures, please, because that's historic.
Yes.
And it may not be there long. It might be quite the collector's item. But anyway, so you're in Washington. One of my bucket lists, one of my rusty pail lists is I want to go like take a full week at the Smithsonian, you know, mm-hmm. just to see everything that interests me. And that would take a full week, I'm sure. So I'm going to do that's one of my goals to do, just like I did Mount Rushmore. It's like, you know, I never saw Mount Rushmore. Bam, I'm at Mount Rushmore. So that's what we're going to do. We're also going to be looking at our lovely and wonderful listeners sent in some emails that I'd like to address. No, I already have them. I don't need to address them. But I mean, to talk about them would be the way to do it. You know, it's going to be different today, Graham. actually, it's not. Now, let me tell you something. before we get to that stuff, before we get to the emails and stuff, I just wanted to mention and say thank you publicly to my co-author of the annotated Abbott and Costello book, actually called the definitive book about Abbott and Costello, if you're interested. But Matthew Conium, I wrote to him before the holidays and told him that, you know, I noticed that in our book, you know, you wrote quite extensively about a movie that Lou Costello produced for Monogram Studios in 1944. It was called A Wave, A Whack, and A Marine, a typical title for a wartime comedy. And I'd never seen it before. I'd never seen it listed. It never showed up on television. And since I was a little boy reading about this, I've been dying to see it. Matthew got a copy of it on eBay when he was writing his portion of our book, and that's how he got to write extensively about it. So I wrote to him and said, Matthew, is there any way of getting that film to me so I can see it? And that would be the last part of the Abbott and Costello film puzzle for me anyway. And sure enough, the day after Christmas on Boxing Day, there it was. He sent it to me, and I got to tell you, it's a beautiful print. It's not like the other Monogram public domain offerings that look like, you know, they were dragged behind a truck through a sea of mud. And those are the good ones. But this one looks like it could be from the vault, you know, from an actual studio print. It's beautiful. So I want to talk about that film because it's really interesting. It's really goofy. It's a little loony. Like Hell's a Poppin' was loony, you know, in that sense. Wow. People talk to the camera. Yeah. no, I'll go into it in more detail. But in the meantime, okay. I want to know how you're doing, Jerry, and where are you at this point? I know everybody knows you were on tour with Miracle on 34th Street. Overruled. And you, you're the judge. And the final week had to be postponed until next season.
Yes.
Due to whatever. So you are in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, we are. We were scheduled to be in Syracuse this week. But the venue decided they would rather run a Christmas show next year in November instead of this year between Christmas and New Year's. And so they rescheduled and it turns out it's just as well that they did, because right now they're getting snow in Syracuse and I'm sitting here in D.C. very comfortable. So I'm not complaining too much.
How odd that they got snow during the winter in upstate New York.
I know.
It's opposite day today here on the podcast. But anyway, enjoy Washington, Jerry. That's it really is an amazing place. You'll enjoy the, like I said, the Trump Kennedy Center and the Trump Lincoln Memorial, Trump Washington Memorial, and the Trump Memorial. But anyway, that's you should have fun there. That's great. In the meantime, how was your Christmas? How was your holiday?
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. It was just quiet. My lovely wife and I, we celebrated together. A few other cast members we got together with for a very impromptu Christmas party. Mm-hmm. But it was really nice. We'd had like 3 days dark, as we say in the business, going into Christmas. And so on the 26th, man, we were just so excited to get back on stage and doing the show again.
Mm. How were your final shows?
Good. Really good. We were at the Capitol
out on High Note.
Tyson's. Yes. The Capitol One Tyson's. Center in Tyson's, Virginia. And it's like a 6-year-old facility that it was odd in that it is a theater that was actually designed by theater people.
Weird.
So the acoustics were incredible, you know, the sight lines and the stage, just everything about it was fantastic.
An actual backstage crossover area and all that stuff. Oh, just
fly
made
space,
for theater.
The whole nine yards. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, that's great. I'm glad you went out on a high note. Pretty soon you'll be going back to real life and performing in the theater of life rather than what you were doing this season. I'm glad you got a chance to do it. And it sounds like you're pretty much wrapped up for next season too, which is wonderful. So you have that to look forward to. In the meantime, Christmas was rather underwhelming here at Casa de Santa Maria. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I wrote about this on Facebook, but people were wondering why I get so upset when Christmas doesn't work out the way I would like it to work out. It's basically because Christmas to me is I sound like Nephew Fred in Christmas Carol, but to me it's a joyous time where you just let go of everything and just be happy, you know? And it's like, it's a choice. And so many people don't make that choice this time of year. Yeah. And it just, it gets me down, you know? So anyway, I tried my best this year and we'll see if it gets better next year. Let's hope. In the meantime, it was 39 degrees this morning in Florida. And I froze my little, took us off. Who took us off? Nobody took us off. And it was, you know, I was shivering as I was walking. If there was an earthquake, it would look like I was standing still. We'll just leave you to figure that out. It's like in California, I knew there was an earthquake happening when my Jell-O would stand still. Okay, so here we are on the podcast. Now let's get right to the meat of this, because I have been waiting really close to 50 years to see this film. And it's called A Wave, A Whack, and a Marine. Now let's discuss this for people who might not know. A Wave was a lady who joined the Navy. She was in the Navy. She was a Wave. A Whack was a woman who joined the Army. That was a Whack. And a Marine, we know, was a cross-dressing. No, wait a minute. No, a Marine was a fighting man. I was thinking of Ed Wood. So yeah, that's the name of the film. But let's do a little preamble on this. For those of you who are real movie buffs, especially really the underbelly of moviedom, you know that Monogram Studios and PRC, Producers Releasing Corporation, and all those were the considered bottom of the barrel, lower tiered entertainments made for the bottom of a double feature. The bottom feature of a double feature. So, you know, Monogram was famous for doing like the East Side Kids with the ex-Dead End Kids. They also did the Bela Lugosi movies from the 40s. And this was a guy by the name of Sam Katzman. Now, Sam Katzman was famous. I mean, he was known as Jungle Sam because he made those cheap jungle movies where, you know, a studio on Sunset Boulevard would be dressed up to look like a jungle. Just look at Africa Screams if you want to. It could have been a Sam Katzman production. But anyway, Sam Katzman was a neighbor of Lou Costello's in the San Fernando Valley, and they were friendly. And Lou had just lost his boy. He had just lost Butch, and he was beside himself, naturally. And Lou's way of dealing with that kind of thing was to work. Was to keep busy. And I know a lot of us are like that. When you deal with something sad or something uncomfortable, you just kind of concentrate on something else until it passes. Well, Lou wanted to work, and Sam knew this and offered to his friend the job as director of the next East Side Kids movie, Blockbusters, it was called. I know this one specifically because I'm a fan of Harry Langdon. I think he's funnier than Harold Lloyd as far as the silent comedians are concerned. He's quirky and funny and original and unique. But in this movie, Blockbusters, he does a cameo that could have been played by anyone. And I mean anyone. Bobby Barber could have played it, you know? And I have no idea. He must have been like hanging around the studio. Hey, Harry, you want to do this three lines? And they called him over and he did this scene with the boys. Well, anyway, regardless of that, this was the movie Lou was supposed to direct. Well, it was written up in the newspapers that Lou was going to direct this movie. Universal's legal department, suddenly the antenna went up and they looked at the contract and Lou could not do this. It was not part of his contract. So he was pulled from that assignment, and Lou, being the cagey person that he was, decided to go around the rules, and he developed his own production company. For some reason, it's called Biltmore Productions, like Biltmore Hotels and stuff like that. Maybe the deal was made at a Biltmore Hotel. I don't know why it says a Biltmore production at the beginning of the movie. But anyway, Lou started this company. He kept his name off of it, such a smarty, and put his father's name on it instead, Sebastian Cristillo. So the company pretty much was made up of Sebastian Cristillo, their business manager, Arnold Bloom, I believe his name was, and the ubiquitous Eddie Sherman, the boys' manager. And this became Biltmore Productions. And they were going to make, they had a contract with Monogram to make, I think, two or three movies. But this was the only one that was made. And I think Lou kind of went to school on this one and realized that being a producer wasn't so easy. So Lou made this movie. And if you look at the opening titles, first of all, like I told you, the print I have is just gorgeous. A card comes up. It is so elegant that says, a Biltmore production. And it's written out beautifully in script and all this stuff. And it looks like an A movie, like you're going to see an A movie. And then the movie starts and you realize you're not going to see an A movie. This is pretty much B-level land, which is perfectly fine because I love B movies. All right. So I want to talk about Lou Costello and another reason I love him so much. This movie is loaded with his friends, coworkers, people he was a fan of when he was a child. He just used this to almost like pay back debts, you know, for help he got in the past and things like that. So let's start with the main one, because the star of this film is Henny Youngman. In 1944, he really is a young man. It's amazing. And, you know, the opening shot of the film is his back walking out of a hotel, and the camera follows him, and you don't see his face. You hear him talking, but you don't see his face. And I have to say that in this movie, I don't know if Phil Carlson, by the way, is a director. He eventually went on to direct like The Silencers, the Matt Helm film and stuff like that. He became like an A-level director, but he started here. Lou sought him out. He was an assistant director on some of their early movies when he was Phil Carlstein. And when Lou finally got around to producing this film, he remembered this kid who used to come to him and suggest gags. And Lou would go to the directors and say, you know what, the kid came up with a funny thing. Let's try this. Lou remembered and sought him out and said, you're going to direct this movie. So Phil Carlson got his first movie thanks to Lou Costello. Now, why Henny Youngman? He's terrible in the movie, by the way. He's just terrible. And I'll get into that and let you know about this. But back in 1938, and we talked about this in the first episode, Henny Youngman was the regular comedian on the very popular Kate Smith radio show. And he would do like a 5 to 10 minute bit every week. And, you know, with Henny Youngman, it was one-liners, one after another, after another. No context whatsoever. And funny. I watched him the past couple of days. I just watched him doing his stand up, and he found something so unique, you know, and so simple, and it's his, completely his. But anyway, he's terrible in this movie. He's not a good actor, but he talks so fast. I couldn't understand half the things he says in this movie. That's what it sounds like. And it's not just him. Everybody, it's like somebody put a gun to their heads and said, talk fast. Everybody talk fast. For some of them, it works. But for like Henny, you can't understand a word he's saying. But anyway, so he's paying back Henny Youngman by giving him the lead in this movie, because Henny, when he left the Kate Smith show, he recommended Abbott and Costello as his replacement. And that started their whole career. They went from that radio show to Broadway, from Broadway to movies, from movies to radio, from radio to television, all thanks to that. And Lou said thank you by giving him the lead in a movie. How about that? And not just that, let's talk about the people that show up in this movie. They're radio cast from the Abbott and Costello radio show. Elvira Allman is in the very first scene, and she played Mrs. Niles on the NBC radio show. Sid Tomac is just wonderful in the first scene. He plays an insurance salesman with a map drawn on his bald head. It's very Olson and Johnson, I'm telling you. The cab driver who shows up during the whole first half of the movie, he's always there. It's Milt Bronson, Abbott and Costello's best friend, who shows up either as dialogue director in every movie or shows up in the movies or the TV shows. He's the man that hands Lou the bat and the baseball cap in the TV show version of Who's on First. Remember? Somebody comes up and says, here, I've got the stuff for you. Oh, you know. Anyway, that's Milt Bronson. So there's another one, another guy. And in the opening titles, there is a special card introducing Henny Youngman, and underneath, Charles Red Marshall. Now, Charles Red Marshall, I could not find a thing on him. He was a burlesque comedian that Lou knew back then and gave him a starring role in this film. I'm sorry. People don't act that way in Hollywood. I'm sorry. No. Yeah, but what a wonderful thing for him to do. So this guy got this incredible opportunity, and I can see why he didn't really carry on. He made a couple of other movies, burlesque-based. One was Lady of Burlesque with Barbara Stanwyck. But he's kind of colorless. He's a great physical comedian. He does some good falls and things like that. But the minute the movie's over, you forget who he is. And you could see why he didn't carry on, you know, with a successful movie career. He probably went back to burlesque and made a nice living doing that. So you had that, okay? So you had paying back a favor to Henny Youngman, a favor to his burlesque friend. Milt Bronson gets a really nice role. His radio people, Freddie Rich and his orchestra is in the movie. Mm. That's their radio orchestra. He also wrote the score for the film, Freddie Rich. Connie Haynes, the singer on the Abbott and Costello Show, shows up, and she is cute as a button. She's the one with that sexy voice. She calls Lou my fat little sugar man. Come here, my fat little sugar man. But boy, she is just cute as a button and tiny. She's tiny. So you have the radio people and the burlesque people, and other people show up, interesting people. Sid Melton. Now, we know Sid Melton from Make Room for Daddy. He was Danny Thomas's manager or agent, made a lot of movies for Eagle Lion, I believe it was, Eagle Lion Studios. He was like their main comedian.
And usually in the summer, he's Melton more than his winter months. But, oh boy, that's a joke he would have got thrown out for. But anyway, Sid shows up in this film in a very small role, very small capacity. I think he's a reporter at the studio. This all takes place at a movie studio. So Sid Melton is involved. I also wanted to mention,
if I may,
some of the other people in the cast. Now, this is not willy-nilly casting. This is Lou Costello sitting down and purposely making these decisions. And I'm going to explain this now. The woman he just worked with in Hit the Ice, which he was very impressed by her, was Elise Knox. We talked about her during that episode of the podcast. She eventually married a football star and announcer Tom Harmon, and is the mother of Mark Harmon, the actor. And I believe there's another, isn't there a daughter that acts as well? Like, I don't know. Harmon, maybe Ethel Harmon? No, that's Merman. Okay, never mind. We have someone who is under contract to Lou, Ann Gillis, who shows up in this film in a starring role. Actually, it's the best friend role, but she's in it all through it. And she shows up in Society, which was made right after this movie was made. So anyway, Ann Gillis is in the movie. Murray Leonard, our pal, Murray Leonard, yes. Pocomoco, who shows up in movies and their television show and everything else. Great burlesque trooper. He shows up in a very small role. We've also got Richard Lane, who ironically is the guy I think often think if Bud could not do a movie, you would hire Richard Lane because he was a great fast-talking straight man, who was also part of a little-known comedy team. If you are a fan of Columbia short subjects, and I know you are, there was one series, and it's considered the best series other than The Stooges, produced by Columbia Studios. That's the truth. It was Schilling and Lane, Gus Schilling and Richard Lane, and their movies are very funny. In fact, when Curly got ill and had to step out of the act, they had already written and scheduled a Stooge short with Curly called Pardon My Terror. It was a haunted house, you know, thing, typical. But the Stooges couldn't do it. So what did they do? They gave it to Schilling and Lane. And it's on YouTube if you want to watch it. And it's very Stoogey. And you see how good these guys are. So we've got Richard Lane. We've got Elise Knox. We've got Ann Gillis. Now, there's somebody fascinating to me in this movie. This is a woman by the name of Mabel Todd. Now, in this movie, she has nothing to do. She plays a manicurist. I think she has like two lines. But Let me talk about her. She was born Mabel Dodds in Glendale, California, in 1907. She was in vaudeville with her sister in a singing act. She had a beautiful, beautiful voice, and then developed a really good jazzy voice. You hear it in a movie called Hollywood Hotel, one of my favorites, one of my favorite musicals of all time. She's teamed with Ted Healy, the guy who, you know, the Stooges, the Three Stooges. Yeah. Again. She's in two movies teamed with him, and they should have continued, but Ted died very young. She worked in vaudeville, and then in 1933, she did a radio show with a guy by the name of Maury Amsterdam, and they got married. Oh. They got married that same year, and they teamed up, and they did a little act together, and blah, blah, blah. Maury Amsterdam was doing a lot during those years. He was also ghostwriting for Will Rogers, helping to write his daily column. But anyway, they were married for 12 years. And in 1943, 2 years before they split up, he wrote her a movie that was produced at PRC, which is just a step below Monogram, Producers Releasing Corporation. And it was a movie called The Ghost and the Guest. And he wrote it for his wife, for Mabel Todd, who plays a supporting role, but it's a big, you know, big supporting role. Mm-hmm. The real stars are James Dunn, who eventually won a Best Supporting Actor in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. And he was already a kind of a hopeless alcoholic at this time. That's why he was at PRC. And Florence Rice, who had every opportunity at MGM to be a star, but just didn't make it.
Yeah.
So here she is from MGM to PRC. You know, at least she's staying with the letters, you know,
yeah,
with the alphabet. So anyway, Maury and Mabel Todd split up in 1945. And apparently the split up was so bitter. It was so awful that Maury Amsterdam never mentioned her name again. You never heard him speak of her. You never heard him mention her. It was that bad. She married again. And it only lasted 3 years. Apparently, this guy beat her up with his shoe. So it wasn't really a soul match. She was in movies. I'm sorry. She was in movies from 1937 to 1946. And it got progressively lower and lower and lower. And apparently, that was it after 46. She shows up in Society. As a manicurist, and there's no billing, and she really has nothing to do. So anyway, she shows up in this movie very, very briefly. She died alone and broke. Catholic Charities had to pay for her burial. Mm. So sad. And that was in 1969. So that's one thing. Now here's another thing. Here's another reason to love Lou Costello. When he was a child, he had certain heroes, movie heroes, that he would follow and go see all their movies. One was William Farnham, who he hired for Jack and the Beanstalk. Mm-hmm. And another was Charlie Chaplin, of course. But the other one was an actor by the name of Jack Mulhall, Mulhall. Leading man all through the silent years. Very good actor. I enjoy his work. Went into talkies, but fell into bit parts, you know, like a lot of silent stars did, and pretty much lingered there, you know. And he had lines, he had roles, he did fairly well. But Lou really loved him and hired him for A Wave, a Whack, and a Marine. And he plays the bartender in the movie, and he gets lines and everything. So I love that Lou sought him out and hired him. Yeah. Probably when he needed it, you know? Anyway, he was in films from 1910 to 1959.
Wow.
So he had a long career. But this is funny about his, not funny, but this is interesting. His first wife died suddenly after their marriage. Their second wife committed suicide. The third wife, which he married that year, that same year, lasted the rest of his life.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, there you go. So that was Jack Mulhall. He passed away, like I said, in 1979. He lived to be 91 years old, which was very unusual back then, you know, like 50 years ago. People weren't living into their 90s. And he was born, by the way, I want to tell you, ready? Wappingers Falls, New York. Wappingers Falls. Now, that's a place I would love to be from. Just, you know, just to say it. Where are you from? Wappingers Falls. It's like you got hit with something and you fall. Wappinger. So that's where Jack Mulhall is from. The other person, two people I want to talk about, and then I'll be done with this movie. One is Alan Dinehart. Now, Alan Dinehart is one of my favorite character actors. He's fabulous in every film he's in. He was born Harold Alan Dinehart in St. Paul, Minnesota in 1889. He studied to be a priest at first, but vaudeville got in the way, and which is more my religion. And so he went into vaudeville. He did his thing. He got into stock companies. He acted, and he signed with Fox, which was not yet 20th Century Fox, in 1931. And he made 88 films in his career from 1931 to 1944. Mm-hmm. And this was his last film, A Wave, a Whack, and a Marine. And he's great in it. Mm-hmm. He even gets to sing a little. I mean, he talks it, but he's part of the final musical number, which I love. And he's very funny in the movie. He gets a lot of good dialogue. He's the harried studio head. So anyway, he was in like 20 Broadway shows. He co-wrote and starred in a Broadway hit called Separate Rooms, and it ran for 613 performances back then. Yeah, that was an enormous hit back then. It is now, too, you know?
Well, yeah.
600. And he wrote on it, you know? He didn't need money. he was pretty wealthy, I'd imagine. Unfortunately, he passed away the same year this movie was released, 1944, of heart disease at the age of 54. So we lost a great character actor and writer as well. All right, the last person I want to talk about is our director, Phil Carlson. Famous amongst film buffs, movies like, well, Live Wires, the very first Bowery Boys movie, which may be my second favorite of all time. It's so good. And Mike Mazurki is so great in it. It's just great. Live Wires. He also did one of my favorite film noirs, Kansas City Confidential, with, get this cast, Preston Foster, Colleen Gray, John Payne, Neville Brand, Lee Van Cleef, and who was the third one? Jack Elam, you know? I mean, every suspect character actor in Hollywood is in that film. I recommend it highly, by the way. It's in public domain and it's on YouTube. The Phoenix City Story, also he directed. Two Matt Helm movies, The Silencers, which is the best of the bunch, in my opinion, and The Wrecking Crew. He also wrote a very popular film from the 70s, I remember, called Walking Tall. His final film was called Framed, which he made in 1975. Now, I just want to say one thing about Phil Carlson. In interviews, he called this movie the worst movie ever made. He also showed great disrespect and... how can I put this? He was not very gracious about the fact that Lou Costello gave him his first directing job and everything came from there. So, you know what, Phil? Okay. Now I feel better.
Wait a minute. Let me wipe my screen down here. Okay. All right.
Oh, where'd you get a squeegee? Wow. That's nice. And it's got sequins on it. That's beautiful.
From the Liberace collection.
I wondered why there was a candelabra on it. Now, just a couple of other things. We did mention the cast members. I did forget the leading lady, Sally Eilers, who was actually much more popular 10 years earlier. She's kind of a little long in the tooth in this one, but she's teamed up romantically with Richard Lane. So it works. They're kind of like the same age. Ramsey Ames, who is a Universal leading lady, beautiful, beautiful woman, has a rather a nice supporting role in this and teamed up with Marjorie Woodworth, who is absolutely terrible. It's as if Phil Carlson walked up to her and said, all right, I want you to be as obnoxious as you can be, as loud as you can be, and just act badly. So that's, and she does it all through the movie. Another one of my favorite character actors has a nice role because he's usually a horrible villain, Cy Kendall. And for movie buffs, you know Cy Kendall. You, if you walked into a prison and Cy Kendall was one of the guards, you knew there was going to be trouble. And finally, the person who gets the last line in the movie. During the finale, there's a finale, and people are talking to the camera, and all through this movie, people talk to the camera. It's like a road picture, or like I mentioned earlier, like Hell's a Poppin'.
Yeah.
So the camera is pulling back, pulling back, pulling back. You start to see studio stuff, you know, blah, 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 pulling back. Then you see the cameraman, and he's behind the camera. You can't tell who it is. He peeks out from the side, and I'm only telling you this because you're probably – you probably don't have access to this movie, so I'll tell you. It's Mel Blanc, also a regular on the Abbott and Costello show. And he says in Porky Pig's voice, that's all, folks. Write to us. And that is the end of the movie. And
oh, my.
Isn't that great?
And Warner's let them get away with that. Okay.
So much so that the Abbott and Costello made two movies, released two movies through them later on. So there you go. That is the story of a wave, a whack, and a marine. And I want to thank Matthew Conium for sending it to me and actually giving it to me as a gift. That's very, very kind of you.
Very.
And Jerry, if you'd like to see it, I'd be happy to mail it to you. So you could watch it as well.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Yes. I know we can't really promise that to all of our listeners, but I'll be more than happy to partake.
Yeah. Oh, no, I wish I could. I don't know how to transfer films into my hard drive. That's my problem. If I could, I would send it to everybody. Yeah. So we have a wave, a whack, and a marine. I want to mention now some people who, very nice people, who sent in questions, comments, and things that Jerry and I can discuss.
Yes.
So I'm going to pull up my email because I saved them all under archive and I will read some of these things to you. First, I'd like to read from Nick Emiliano Santiago. That's his name. And Nick is spelled N-I-C. Okay. Just dropping a line to let you know that my aching back New Year's Day was rescued by your phenomenal ANC podcast via YouTube. As a classic comedy fanatic from childhood, just to be able to listen in on your great conversations film by film has been a genuine pleasure. Between icing, muscle relaxers, and ouch. Thank you. Now on to Rio Rita. So he's going film by film. And it's making him feel better. So, Jerry, we are doing a nice thing.
And apparently the podcast is much more entertaining if you're taking muscle relaxers.
Yeah, I'd like to say something about that if I could. And it's this. Okay. Okay.
May we quote you on that?
Yeah, yes, you may, but you have to record it so I can see it. All right, Jody Value. That's how you pronounce her name. It's V-A-L-Y-O-U, Value. And you get good value from Jody. It says, greetings, gentlemen, which is suspect already. First, I would like to thank you both for all you do to keep the memories of the boys alive in all of our hearts. I love the podcast. It's the highlight of my week at least two times a month or more as I listen to the older episodes over again and again. Second, I am hoping that Nick will be able to find more lost episodes of the Bud Abbott Variety Show. I can't tell you how many times I've laughed so hard while driving that the cars next to me at a stoplight looked at me very wide-eyed and concerned.
Certainly.
Third, are we ever going to hear some interviews with some of the boys' surviving family? Chris Costello is one of the sweetest people that I have ever spoken to. We've conversed through messages and email a lot. She's always willing to answer my questions that I may have about Bud and Lou. And the film script books that she's made available over the last few years are amazing. I have every single one now. Fourth, I would like to congratulate Jerry on his successful run with Miracle on 34th Street. I was really hoping that you would have made it to Knoxville, Tennessee. I would have loved to see the show. It's one of my favorite holiday movies. Fifth and final, I just want to thank you both again for all the love you put into the show. It shines through with every new episode. I consider Nick as my classic comedy guru. He usually always has an answer to most of my ridiculous, obscure questions. One more thing. I almost forgot. A message to all of the listeners. If you get the chance to take one of Nick's online classes, I highly recommend it. I took his The Art of Abbott and Costello just over 2 years ago, and it was so much fun. You'll have a great time. Sincerely, your biggest fan, Jody Value. Jody, thank you so much.
Yes.
Isn't that sweet, Jer?
Yes, very. Thank you, Jody. Wow.
That was so nice. Thank you. As far as your questions, Chris Costello. Now, I've known Chris for almost 40 years, and she is in another, how can I put this? She's in another neighborhood. Let me put it that way. Abbott and Costello-wise, she is friendly with the guys who wrote the book 35 years ago, Bob Fermanek and Ron Palumbo. They wrote Abbott and Costello in Hollywood. Great book, by the way, but ours is better. But anyway, so Chris, she's not really into Matthew and I, and she tends to be more open to the other guys. So I don't know why. I've confronted her about it. She felt put upon, and it just wasn't good. So I do think she's very nice. And like I say, I've known her for years. In fact, way back when, I had a real crush on her. But that's that. So that's my answer. Other than that, I just have to thank you. Thank you for being a loyal listener and yes, for enjoying it so much. Okay, here's another one from Phil Ivory. Wow, I wish you'd get off my piano. It says here, a couple of films I wish they had made. Here we go. Who's On First? Such a natural, and not just the famous routine, but a story set in a baseball stadium. John Grant would go crazy with it, and it would be their go-to movie today, based on the title alone. I know there was talk of doing a series of sports-themed films. That would have been much more natural than some of the other ideas they used. And you know what? I agree. I think that would have been a great idea. Sports comedies. They worked so well for Joey Brown in the early 30s or mid-30s, but Bud and Lou could have carried on with that. It would have been great. Bud is the manager. You know, Lou is the player. Yeah. Here's a great one. Abbott and Costello meet Sherlock Holmes. Now, they're both at the same studio, right? Working at the same place. I know they wanted to get Basil Rathbone for Jekyll and Hyde. This would be a better choice and could use the same sets. Imagine the boys as amateur sleuths trying to help Holmes but mucking up the world. Watson could be on holiday since Lou will take his place as the guy that Holmes is much smarter than. I think Rathbone would have had fun with it. I also would have liked to see one about the boys being involved in a Broadway show. That's it. Thanks for keeping memories of the boys alive through your great podcast. From Phil Ivory. Wow, Phil, that's really, I'm gonna ask you, Jerry, what you think, but I love the idea of the Sherlock Holmes meetup. It could have been Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein before Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, you know, with that kind of arrangement. And, you know, foggy London. It just, I don't know. I think that's a great idea. As far as a Broadway show, being in like in a musical where you actually see the numbers being played on the stage and Bud and Lou are the ones trying to put it on. I could see it, definitely.
Yeah.
Great ideas, Phil. What do you think, Jared?
It's like, it sounds like Bud and Lou do White Christmas, you know, but.
Which would work.
No, I think they're all great ideas. The Sherlock Holmes one just fascinates me. I'm all ready to pick up a pen and see what I can put down on paper for that one.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, it would be great. The Who's On First, I see it as yet another opportunity for some of the other routine, like, you know, mustard on a hot dog, you know.
Definitely.
It's better to talk about hot dogs than at the ballpark, you know? I mean,
exactly. Or why'd you come to the stadium, right?
Yeah.
Do you know what teams are playing? That whole thing. No, it could have worked beautifully. And they were planning a Who's On First movie, by the way, with Joe DiMaggio.
Ooh.
It didn't happen, apparently. Okay. I do want to mention one thing before I forget, my buddy, Joe Yakovetic, that's his name, Yakovetic, he illustrated a beautiful book. It's called Fred Stone and the Frontier Circus. And it's written by P.J. Sloan, who is related to Fred Stone, who wrote these stories, but not only wrote these stories, he was a character actor in Hollywood. He was Will Rogers' best friend, and he was in a comedy team at the turn of the century with Montgomery and Stone. And together, they were in the very first stage presentation of The Wizard of Oz. And I'm not sure if it was the exact title, but he was the first person to play the Scarecrow. Mm-hmm. And yeah, an incredible, incredible person with an incredible career. And this book, this is one of 50 books that my friend Joe has illustrated. And it's available. You could look it up. It's called, oh, by the way, this is the granddaughter of Fred Stone, is P.J. Sloan. So yeah, that's the name. It's called Fred Stone and the Frontier Circus. All right. I just wanted to plug that for my buddy.
Sure.
Okay. So that's out of the way. Commercial's out of the way. Let's see what the next thing is here. This is from Falcon Bird of Prey. That's his address name. But okay. This is actually Bill. Bill Honor is his name. H-O-N-O-R. Look, Bill's Honor. Okay. Hello, Nick and Jerry. So nice to see that you're helping to keep the memory of Bud and Lou alive. I love that. Everybody's saying that. Mm-hmm. I always get excited knowing possibly another generation of youth might appreciate them. I was just 16 when I traveled from Howard Beach, New York, to Woodland Hills, California, to meet and spend the afternoon with Bud and Betty Abbott in their lovely home. That was 1968. I'm now 73 and remember it like it was yesterday. You see, it means a lot to me what you guys are doing. My question to you both is, what is it inside you that feels so important that you choose Bud and Lou as subject matter? I'm hoping to subscribe to your podcast. Take care. Hope you both had a great Christmas and wishing you both a happy and healthy new year. Sincerely, Bill Honor from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Bill, that was lovely. Thank you so much. And we appreciate it. I'll answer first, and then I'm going to hand it to you, Jer. This podcast and the book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, was basically put together because we felt terrible that Bud and Lou were considered like second-tier comedians, when the truth of the matter is they're as good as any of the others. Laurel and Hardy, Martin and Lewis, the Marx Brothers, all they're in the same category as far as I'm concerned, and I never understood why it was thought otherwise. Some people nowadays, they think of them like in the same breath as Ma and Pa Kettle or Francis the Talking Mule, those movies. It's ridiculous. These movies are so much fun. Abbott and Costello are so talented. They are so funny. And I don't accept the fact that they're second tier. They're, in fact, again, in a culture that accepts the Three Stooges as the ultimate of black and white comedy, I feel no compunction about saying that Abbott and Costello made them look sick. I'm sorry, but they did. All right, so Jerry, why did you jump aboard this?
Well, you know, you always get to go first because then I just sit here and go, yes, I agree, because that's pretty much the same reason for me. Back, I can't remember when this happened, I stumbled across some conversation on Facebook. It may have been in the Marx Brothers Council Facebook page. Mm-hmm. You had spouted something about Abbott and Costello. Somebody mm-hmm. responded to your comment, you ought to do a podcast about Abbott and Costello. And you replied to that saying, well, if I could find somebody to produce it.
That's right. I remember.
And I was the idiot that responded.
You may be an idiot, Jerry, but you're my idiot. Okay. There's a difference.
But the reason that I responded was because, yes, I am 100% agreement with you. They are so underrated. I challenge anybody to think of another comedy team that when you mention their names, everybody in the world only thinks of one of their bits. Mm-hmm. You say the Marx Brothers, and people will go off on any one of their movies and the routines and some of the songs they did. You know, mm-hmm. the Stooges, as you've said, so many different examples that people will pop up. You say Abbott and Costello, people say, who's on first?
Right, exactly. That's if they know who's on first.
Yes. Well, quite honestly, I have told people about this podcast. Theater friends of mine, surprisingly, who I'm doing a podcast about Abbott and Costello. Who's that?
Who?
I say, have you heard Who's on First? Oh, yeah, those guys.
It's so weird. It is so weird. Now, in a sense, that one routine does describe them.
It does.
Describes their dynamic. You know, Bud is like trying to explain something to Lou that makes perfect sense to Bud. Lou takes it in another direction and doesn't understand it at all. And yeah, that's their crosstalk routines. But yep, there's so much more. There's so much more. There's Lou Costello's pantomimic skills. There's his comic genius timing. There's Bud's straight man skills that you just marvel at. I mean, I'm sorry, but you know, if you feel that Abbott and Costello are second tier, you're wrong. Okay, so that's all there is to it. Now, I want to make a special request to Bill Honor. Would you please write me again and tell me as much as you remember about your visit with Bud and Betty Abbott?
Yes.
And I will read it in the next podcast, okay? Because I'm sure we're all interested in that.
Yes, yes, okay? Yes.
So very cool. That is just so cool. All right, let's see who's next. We did get a nice response this time around. Okay, here's my buddy Dan Young. Dan Young. It sounds like something you'd order at an Asian restaurant. Okay, question for the upcoming podcast. I have the big box set of Abbott and Costello on DVD, which is certainly well done and essential for vintage comedy fans. Having said that, what are the chances we could get some of their best work issued on Blu-ray with commentary by you guys? Oh, Dan. Oh, Dan. Yeah, yeah. When I listen to Frank Conniff, you know, from Mystery Science Theater, mm-hmm, doing the commentary for a great film like Whodunit, and he knows nothing about the film, and he knows nothing about the people in it, he's just kind of repeating what we just saw. And I wonder, why didn't they, like, hire Matthew or me, you know, or Jerry to, you know, discuss what we know about? Yeah. It's ridiculous. So Dan, we're kind of out of the loop. You know, my entire career has always been, I was in mainstream, but I was kind of the outsider. You know what I mean? I never really followed all the rules and all that stuff. So even in this sense, I'm that way. I'm on the outside. So, you know, and like I said earlier, you know, people like Chris Costello and Bob Furmanek and people like that, they go their own way. And it's kind of like they really don't consider us. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I have to find it in these wonderful messages from you guys.
On the other side of that question.
Yes, sir.
The films are, in fact, in the process of all being Blu-rayed.
Well, all the 28 Universals that were released are Blu-ray.
There at least is that. You've got the better quality.
That's a wonderful thing about, number one, Classic Flicks releasing the television show, the series, in Blu-ray and looking and sounding gorgeous. Jack and the Beanstalk, Africa Screams, Noose Hangs High. They did it for all of them. So, we're good in that department. But, Dan, we'd love to be commentating on these films. But we're outsiders. What can I tell you? Here's my friend Sam Eichner, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing that. It's not Eichner, it's Eichner. And he says, "Hey, Nick Mann," that's me. I'm a superhero that causes shaving accidents. Nick Mann. So glad to have had the opportunity to get to know you this year. Yeah, Sam, you're a good pal. My question is, we always hear that a lot of Abbott and Costello's bits are from vaudeville and they just did them better than others. Can you elaborate on that? And are there any other performers that also graduated from the vaudeville stage to movies? Was there any that came out and said, "Hey, the boys stole that bit from us"? I'd love to hear you share more about vaudeville. Thanks, Sam. All right, Sam, we discussed this. I wrote you immediately after getting this and correcting you. It's burlesque and not vaudeville. Vaudeville was a completely different thing and was pretty much dead by the time Bud and Lou got together in burlesque. So, what Bud and Lou did is they hired John Grant to adapt these wonderful burlesque routines for the talents of Abbott and Costello, which was one of the wisest decisions they ever made. And the truth of the matter is, as bitter as a lot of the burlesque performers were, seeing how successful Bud and Lou became using the material that these guys were using night after night, you know, two shows a day, it must have been galling for them, you know, to see these guys become the biggest stars in the world at this point, which kills me. It just kills me. These two burlesque performers became the most popular movie stars in the world. Anyway, there are other graduates from burlesque, and I'll just rattle off a few. Early on, you had Burt Lahr, you had W.C. Fields, then you had Phil Silvers, you had Red Buttons. Who else? Were there any other teams? I don't think there were any other teams that came out of burlesque. But there were those performers that made good careers for themselves. My problem is, everyone I mentioned, especially like Red Buttons and Phil Silvers, no, even the other ones, Fields and Burt Lahr, they were given better treatment by Hollywood. They were considered, you know, like Burt Lahr was invited to parties, Bud and Lou weren't. You know, Phil Silvers was part of the elite of Hollywood. He would show up at studio heads and do bits by the piano, and then people from the other studios would hire him, you know, just based on that. But he was accepted into mainstream Hollywood. W.C. Fields became a star, you know, star comedian in the early 30s, mid-30s, into the 40s. You know, it's like you come from burlesque. And unfortunately, Bud and Lou had this stigma about them. And I don't know what it was. I don't know why Hollywood looked down on them. Maybe it's because they worked at Universal, which was like an A-minus studio. Mm. Maybe it's because Universal milked them dry by making them make 6 movies in a year. you know, I don't know. Maybe it was their lowbrow way of talking. Maybe it was the fact that they didn't seem educated, you know, in the sense that most people are educated. Phil Silvers was very well-spoken and had a great vocabulary and talked about Schopenhauer and Freud in his bits, you know. But Abbott and Costello were bare bones, burlesque, slapstick, greatest crosstalk ever. Somebody was asking me about the movie The Coconuts with the Marx Brothers yesterday, in fact. And now that these movies are becoming more available due to public domain and all that stuff, I had to say, you know, I don't find The Coconuts funny. I don't find it funny at all, to be honest with you. I think they're all working on half steam. You know, they're not used to movies yet. Groucho could be anybody, as far as I'm concerned, in this movie. There are other comedians like Groucho in this movie. Chico is half asleep. Harpo's the only one who comes off well. Zeppo's not even in it. You know, and it's like, but you know, it's like people were saying, well, what about the Wyoduck routine? And I say, you know, it's cute. It's cute. It doesn't make me laugh out loud. Not like an Abbott and Costello crosstalk routine. They don't do it as well as Bud and Lou. And that's why Bud and Lou rose to the top. And I mean the top. So anyway, that's my answer on that one. And as far as stealing bits, burlesque was open for anybody. These bits were public domain. Some people copyrighted them, you know, just to say they owned them. But the truth of the matter is everybody used these routines. Abbott and Costello used them better than anybody else.
Yes. And that's that really is the main key to it. And you know, this brings up a point that my wife mentioned. I told her, you know, what direction we were going in this episode here. Mm-hmm. And she had something to contribute. She and I had gone to see a local production of Damn Yankees. Mm-hmm. And before the show, two of the cast came out in front of the curtain in their baseball uniforms and did Who's On First.
Oh my God.
As a warm up. Yeah. And I have to say, one of them is a dear friend of mine. But fortunately he was playing Bud's role, because the guy that was playing Lou did not understand it's a minor point, but it's what makes Bud and Lou the best at this routine. He was not frustrated. He was angry.
Oh no.
And I sat there going,
that drives people away.
Yes. That was, mm-hmm. oh, And my son at 9, he and I did Who's On First. He understood that mm-hmm. it was frustration and not anger, you know?
But, you know, I can understand that because children relate to Lou Costello.
Yes.
You know, he's a kid. He's a fellow child. So
yeah.
I get that. I totally
but that
get
was,
it.
That's one of the points that made them better than everybody else. Yeah, it may have been the same routine, but they knew how to put it over. As we've said before, Bud, as a straight man, none better. His timing, his delivery, he knew how to set up his comedian, and it always worked.
He was the best. He was yep. the best there was. And Lou, I'm sorry, he was the best there was, as far yep. as I'm concerned. It was incredible stuff. I've been watching those YouTube videos of people watching Who's On First for the first time.
Mm.
People who have never heard of Abbott and Costello.
Yep.
And it never fails. They are... they're breathless by the end. It's just an amazing experience. It really is. I want to thank everybody for writing in. That was a lot of fun. I like that.
Yeah.
We should make that a regular thing. So I'm going to say that. My email address is nsm555@msn.com. Please feel free to write to me and Jerry, and we will discuss whatever you send. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. If you have really nice things to say to the both of us, send them in there. If you have complaints, talk to Nick.
It's okay. I'm used to it. I was married. couple of other things, by the way, before I forget.
Yes.
There is a documentary on YouTube I'm going to recommend to everybody. If you haven't heard of Charlie Gamora, then you're just not a film buff.
No.
It almost sounds like something from Finian's Rainbow, the play Finian's Rainbow. How are things in Charles Gamora? How are things in Charles Gamora? Anyway, he was probably Hollywood's top gorilla man. He built his own gorilla suit, but he was part Filipino, very small. He was 5'1", and he was a genius. And you'll see it. If you go to the thing, it's called Charles Gamora Uncredited. That's the name of the documentary. It's 2 hours, and it is fascinating. He was so much more than a Hollywood gorilla. I mean, his mentor was Lon Chaney Sr., as far as makeup. And he was practically a member of the Westmore family makeup dynasty. And he created makeups you're not going to believe, things you've been watching your whole life. So I'm going to recommend that. Charlie Gamora played the gorilla in Africa Screams. So he worked with the boys.
Yeah.
And also with the Marx Brothers in At the Circus. He was Goliath. Okay, so that's out of the way. But this is the biggie now. There is a magazine that has been dormant for 3 years now, but it just came out with a new issue, and it's really a good magazine. If you're a film buff, especially a comedy buff, it's called Comique, you know, named after the studio, Roscoe Arbuckle's studio, Comique. And there's an article by an old friend of mine by the name of Ed Watts. Now, if you're a Wheeler and Woolsey fan, you know he wrote the book on Wheeler and Woolsey. And my friend James Neubauer also wrote one recently that was recently released about their films. But Ed's was the first, and it was about 35 years ago. And he is the one that not only did he send me a book autographed, which is just wonderful. It's one of my treasured things. But he got me in touch with Dorothy Lee, Wheeler and Woolsey's leading lady.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably the last 3 years of her life, and we became very close. Mm. I was the last person, I think, to talk to her before she passed away. I was definitely the last person to tell her, I love you. That's for sure. But she was an amazing lady, and I will forever be grateful to Ed Watts for that. That said, he wrote an article for this magazine called When Bud Was Funnier Than Lou. And basically, it's about the second season of their television show, where Bud got a lot of punchlines. And I'm going to explain that to all of you and to Ed as well. Now, Ed, in this article, makes it known that he doesn't like any of the Abbott and Costello movies except Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Now, I know that's a popular thing nowadays. He loves the television show. There's no songs. There's no romantic subplot. There's nothing you really need to pay attention to. Yeah, it's perfect for the Three Stooges loving culture that we have right now. It's 24 minutes of just solid comedy, no life lessons, just funny. Funny stuff. but it's not done as well as they do it in the movies. I'm sorry. Watch their earlier movies and you see them on fire. And they are just wonderful. Right, Jar? They're on fire. Yeah. And, you know, even later on, you know, then they start trying new things and they do Little Giant and they do Time of Their Lives. And then they start doing more story-driven movies, you know, developing more of what the public wanted at post-war years. You know, so Ed, I'm a little disappointed. He mentions that he likes the Wheeler and Woolsey movies better. And, you know, after I threw up a little in my mouth, I had to just shake my head and say, oh boy. I want to remind Ed that I'm only making these comparisons because I feel I can. And no offense, I don't know if anyone really knows who I am or what I've done in my life. But for the past 50 years, I've been in show business. Not just show business, but making people laugh. Mm-hmm. I'm a laugh maker. I always have been. I've been on Broadway, you know, with permission to ad lib. Because that's what I do. I've learned what makes an audience laugh. I've learned what timing makes them laugh. I've learned all of that stuff in 50 years. So when I look at Bud and Lou work, I know what they're thinking. I could look in their eyes and know what they're thinking. I know when they're not connecting. I know when one of them is in trouble and looking at the other for help. I know all this stuff. It's all there. And they're wonderful. They're just wonderful. Then you started going off, Ed, I'm talking to Ed personally, you started going off about Lou and, you know, making him look bad. And I'm getting a little tired of that whole thing. It's like, I think people believe that horrible movie that came out about them or the horrible book by Bob Thomas. I think we've proven, Jerry and I have proven what a really kind and sweet and generous man he was. Yes. You know, if he had an Italian temper, fine. So do I. Okay, what can I tell you? And if you feel he treated Bud badly by asking for more money, I don't agree with you. I'm sorry. Lou killed himself to make us laugh. Bud walked off camera and said, I'm going to get a sandwich. You do the bit. So, yeah, that's the way I feel. And Ed, that article, it's like I was going to download the magazine, but I don't want that on my hard drive. So anyway, I hope it makes you think. And I know I'm not going to change your mind, but I just wanted you to know how I felt about it. Okay? Sort of a letter to the editor, I guess, you know, yeah. Done in real time.
There you go.
Well, Jerry, I hate to say this because my favorite time is doing our podcast, and I've run out of things to say. There's no more to do.
Well, then we definitely have to mark this date on the calendar. Nick has run out of things to say.
It's true. I mean, well, you know, we did. I'm gonna level with our audience.
Yep.
The first 24 minutes of this podcast was recorded 2 days ago on New Year's Eve. It's now January 2nd, Friday, January 2nd. Jerry was in a hotel at the time that did not have great internet. So we had to cut it off at 24 minutes. And today we picked it up from where we left off. This is actually two pieces put together just for you, and your entertainment. Your entertainment value has just gone up. So that's it, guys. I mean, here's what I'm thinking about for our next episode, Jerry.
Yes.
I want to talk about teams that were inspired by Abbott and Costello. Back in the 1940s, when the Abbott and Costello came out and they became the thing, every studio had to have a comedy team. So we're going to look at what the studios decided to do to compete with Universal Studios and Abbott and Costello.
Nice.
Sound good?
I love it. I love it.
Yeah, me too. And Jerry, it's so good to have you back. I mean, I know, you know, you're off the road now. Yeah. What are you going to do now, by the way?
I am gainfully unemployed at the moment. as is usually the case with actors, you know, this, Nick, is no news to you, but it may be news to some of our listeners. Even when you're in the middle of a project, you meet other actors and they say, what have you got coming up next? You're always looking ahead to the next job.
That's it.
And so I'm trying to line up some things for the, for the future.
I always said that if you choose to be in show business, your life becomes a series of job interviews.
Yes.
Now, if you hate job interviews, don't become an actor. Don't become a show business person. Because that's all it is. That's what auditions are. job interviews.
Well, and you know, I always tell people this, you know, as an actor, my least favorite part of the entire process is the audition. But it's a necessary evil.
You're alone in that, Jerry. I don't think you're alone. But I did learn, as someone who sat on the other side of the table and had to hire actors for like shows I've written, you have to look beyond that. You have to, what you're looking for, and this is what you learn as you go, you want to present yourself as someone they want to work with. And that doesn't necessarily have to do with the talent you're displaying. It has to do with your personality and what you're giving them as far as your, you know, pliability and conviviality. You know, that's most important.
Oh,
you know, if they're going to spend that much time with you, they want to like you. It's true.
Very true.
That's why I never worked. So, okay. We are wrapping up now, and I finally got to see A Wave, A Whack, and A Marine. Jerry, you will be seeing it soon, I promise you.
Yay.
And one more thing. I have a friend by the name of Gary Goldstein. He was a book editor for like 30, 35 years in New York City with big companies. And he was working for the company that published Abbott and Costello in Hollywood, the book from, you know, Bob Fermanek and Ron Palumbo. And 30, whatever, 5 years ago, my buddy sent me a free copy of that book. And in the book was a letter from him saying, it's a good book, but the print is too small. And it was, and it is. Mm. It's very, very tiny. Our book is so much easier to read. But anyway, what I'm getting at is my friend, the book editor, recently came back into my life after being away for a while, and he didn't know about my book. So I sent it to him, and I can't wait to hear what he has to say because he's it, you know, he's been in the business for years and years.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that. Anyway, Jerry, I'm also looking forward to seeing you again when we record again. And we're going to look at the comedy teams inspired by Bud and Lou.
Sounds fantastic. All
right. Jerry, you take care. Good luck at home at adapting back to winter in Washington. Give my hellos to your lovely wife.
I will do that.
And tell her to kiss the cat for me, because I know you know.
I don't have to tell her that. She's doing it constantly. She does it so much, I'm getting a hairball. I mean,
you know. You know, my mother was a hairstylist, and she used to go to the hairball all the time. Anyway, Jerry, you take good care of yourself, and I will
see you, my friend,
very soon. Thank you. And to all of you out there, thank you for listening, and thank you for your nice words. We appreciate it. Take care.